And this is actually one of the more bullish developments for Bitcoin over the last year. Saylor's selling a ton of Bitcoin now. He has inoculated the market of that fear. These developments are not relevant to the long-term structural integrity of any of this.
Joe Consorti is a rising star in the Bitcoin and finance world, with a sharp eye for macro trends and deep expertise in the Bitcoin market.
He's been a key player in developing an innovative asset-backed liquidity metric, reshaping how we understand market liquidity.
It's simply a crowding out as a result of the AI trade. There's only so much capital to go around. Everything else might not be accurately pricing in the risks here, and Bitcoin is the only accurate one that is. But it seems like Team 4-Year Cycle is still in the lead here. We are still in a bear market, unfortunately.
Hey guys, I hope you've been enjoying the episodes I've been putting out as much as I do. For me, it's been a great journey with less noise, more signal, talking to all these experts all the time. With each and every episode, I feel like I have new points to ruminate on, things to ponder over. And yeah, I've just been learning so much. So if it's the same for you, I'd appreciate you subscribing to the show on YouTube, also commenting with the episodes when you have something to say, like it and share with your friends and families and colleagues. That would be much appreciated. And that way we could reach more people with this great content and grow together. So thanks a lot for doing this. Much appreciated. And yeah, let's go. Hey guys, welcome back to Less Noise, More Signal. Joining me today is Joe Consorti. It's great to have you back, Joe, on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, and good day for it too.
Yes, exactly. Good day. We got a bunch to talk about, but maybe just quickly, what have you been up to? Yeah,
for sure. I have been up to a couple of things. So the YouTube channel, I've been working really hard on that, posting regular content, helping folks navigate Bitcoin and global markets. The goal is to help every viewer leave 1% smarter than they came in. And that's, you know, essentially the aim. So making videos on there 3 times a week, and that's been fun. And then also my wife and I are expecting our first baby here in just 7 weeks. So very excited about it. Very busy season of life. So we're excited for it.
Yeah, I see. Interesting. Yeah, I know some of my listeners already know I became a dad a couple of months ago as well. And it's been, well, not a hell of a journey, but it's been great. You know, life changes after that. So you got something to look for sure. Amazing. Well, I mean, let's get straight into the topics. You know, I think the best way to start out is probably to talk about the news that just hit this morning, you know, with Strategy selling 32 Bitcoin, I think it is, about 2.5 million or something that they sold as of prices as of now. So what do you make of it?
Yeah. So it's a nothing burger, right? Ultimately, this is one of the three things that Saylor said he was going to do in order to inoculate the market and make this a less scary thing. So like for those of you who might be unaware, obviously Strategy hasn't sold any Bitcoin since 2022. There's a misconception that they've never sold their Bitcoin before. Not true. They sold 704 BTC in 2022, which is quite a lot, relative especially to the amount that they sold today. So they only sold 32 Bitcoin today, which is 0.0038% of their holdings. That's like if you owned one Bitcoin and you sold 3,800 sats. Right. So it's actually nothing. I'm not being hyperbolic. And so the reason they did it is not because they were a forced seller. It's because they're trying to prove to the market that they can sell Bitcoin if needed. Right. That's why it was such an inconsequential amount, because one of the major detractions, not just from the market at large, but more importantly, committees like the S&P 500 Inclusion Committee that decides whether your equity will be listed on the S&P 500 index or not, have said one of the major downside risks to Strategy is that they've never shown they can sell Bitcoin before, at the very least, not for tax loss harvesting purposes. So we had tax loss harvesting back in 2022. That's why they sold 704 Bitcoin. But Strategy hasn't shown that they can sell BTC and be okay without the need for buying it back, right? Obviously, they're going to continue doing purchases, but this was just a measure to increase the likelihood that they're included in the S&P 500, which is, in a way, actually the most bullish thing that can happen for Bitcoin. And so it sounds a bit counterintuitive. One of the largest institutional structural buyers, if not the largest institutional structural buyer of Bitcoin, selling it, actually being bullish. But if you actually think about the second and third order effects, which I always encourage my viewers to do, then this is actually one of the more bullish developments for Bitcoin over the last year.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a good take for sure. You mentioned 2022 when they sold the Bitcoin that you brought up. I mean, as you said, it was for tax loss harvesting that they did it. It was, they weren't a forced seller there either. But then at the same time, a lot of people are pointing to the fact that Saylor has been very adamant about sell your kidney for Bitcoin, never sell your Bitcoin, you know, and that's what people kind of think they're now disappointed in, you know. They also, maybe some of them point to, you know, MSTR when they you know, they said about the NAV that they had, MNAV, they're not going to sell Strategy shares at that price, but then they did for some reasons as well. So I guess a lot of people are just kind of disappointed in Saylor. So what do you think? Is that relevant at all? Or like, how do you validate this, you know, or evaluate this?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they're valid criticisms, right? I won't tell anyone who is disappointed in the fact that these things happened when they were told they wouldn't happen, that they're wrong for feeling disappointed. But what I will say is that as far as MicroStrategy as a company is concerned, as far as their products, their perpetual preferred instruments are concerned, and most importantly, as far as their Bitcoin holdings are concerned, these developments are not relevant to the long-term structural integrity of any of those things, which is what you want to hear, right? The last thing you would want is for Saylor to be selling Bitcoin because he had to, right? Or Saylor missing a dividend date, right? You know, those things are actual major red flags as far as the company's health is concerned. But given the fact that he's doing these during a time when Bitcoin is really boring and not doing anything, if anything, the people who are disappointed actually shouldn't be disappointed. It should be the opposite. Now, it sounds counterintuitive, but let me explain. Think about it this way. If only people in the market who are extremely bearish over your company are saying, well, when you guys sell Bitcoin, you're going to collapse. Wouldn't it be an extremely good development for that company to then say, okay, times are good. We have a really fat balance sheet. We have like decades worth of dividend coverage. How about we sell like 32 Bitcoin, like an inconsequential amount in order to prove to the market that we can without blowing up? And then they do. Like in actuality, this is a tremendous development. Now, I'm not, I'm not trying to hype these guys up and I'm not trying to do anything like that. But the fact of the matter is, in my mind, this is a positive development that really knocks out one of the major bear points about Strategy. Obviously, you and I both know that they don't actually have any leverage on their balance sheet. They just bought back a ton of their converts. And so they're almost done buying back all of their debt. And so, you know, these perpetual preferred instruments, they're not actually debt obligations. And so in a way, right, this company's balance sheet health is extremely strong and it's nothing to be afraid of. Like you and I both know that, obviously, but for the wider market, they don't know that. And so them selling Bitcoin and then proving to the market over the next couple of weeks that they can't collapse is actually a very good thing, right? It's almost like, you know, introducing a little bit of chicken pox to yourself through a vaccine, right? Or introducing a little bit of measles to yourself through a vaccine. You're essentially allowing your immune system to learn how to fight that before, so that way you are inoculated and you're immune to it. In the same way, Saylor's selling a ton of Bitcoin. Now, he has inoculated the market of that fear, right? Of the notion that Strategy, upon selling their Bitcoin, will enter into a death spiral or whatever. So this is actually quite a positive development for BTC.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, that's a good way to explain it as well. I mean, one thing that some people might bring up is just because they're selling, okay, couldn't this at some point spiral out of control? You know, he has sold 32 Bitcoins by now, testing the market, that's all right. You know, it's exactly what he should be doing, as you explained. But what if like these dividend payments, you know, that he will have to cover in USD, you know, what if they are not sort of, if that's not sustainable, you know, and he will have to sell more just to cover these dividends, you know, and then it spirals from 32 Bitcoins to 100. And then at some point it will be 1,000. And, you know, that's kind of like probably what people are worried over as well, you know, given that, I guess, I don't know, it could be, there might be a ceiling to this, obviously, you know, maybe 1.7 billion in dividend payments that he will have to cater to over the next year. I guess that would be the ceiling, but there could be some substantial amount that he will be selling, you know? So I think there is a risk there. Wouldn't you agree?
I mean, there's a risk in the event that Bitcoin's price drops precipitously. Right now, they have 35.2 years of BTC coverage. And they have a cash reserve, but the cash reserve, again, was mostly just performative to show the S&P committee that, look, we could put cash on the balance sheet as needed, even if Bitcoin fell by 50%, which I think you and I can both agree is sort of a tall order. I mean, it might, even if that happened, they would still have 17.6 years of dividend coverage, you know? So like that would mean Bitcoin at 35 thousand. And at which case I would be like selling every asset I own to buy more Bitcoin. You know, and so even at that level, they would still have well over a decade and a half of dividend coverage. And so for me, it's not something that's necessarily all that scary. And also you gotta think, like, in times like these, they have a couple of different levers. Number one, they can lower the dividend. Obviously, they don't want to because they're using Stretch as a Bitcoin accumulation vehicle. And when Bitcoin is at a discount, relative to where they think it should be valued, they want to keep the dividend high so they can entice new capital to come in so they could buy more Bitcoin, right? But like if worst comes to worst, they could decrease the dividend to 10.5%, 10%, 9.5%, which is still extremely enticing relative to the wider market. You got to remember, not only is the average high yield corporate bond like 6.5% today, 7% today, but Stretch actually debuted at 9%. So it's 11.5% because that is what we landed on eventually. But if Bitcoin falls into a bear market, then ultimately they can simply decrease the dividend rate if they need to and extend their years of dividend coverage. Now, I don't think that that's what they're going to do, but they have numerous levers to pull, not to mention the extreme amount of runway, even in worst case scenarios where it's just not something I'm worried about. Obviously, those are risks though, right? And it's important to be transparent about those risks and understand those risks. But I think, like, you know, and I think you and I can both agree, like a lot of the folks who are out here saying that Strategy is a Ponzi scheme, it's going to zero, yada, 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 it's just baseless. And in my mind, it's sort of the Michael Burry syndrome, what I'm calling it. Ever since people watched the movie The Big Short, which is actually the most popular finance movie in business schools, probably globally, but at least I know in the United States, because I was going to business school at the time, you know, everyone wants to think that they have found the next bubble, or they have found the next, you know, massive asymmetric downside asset that nobody else has seen before. And so because of this Michael Burry syndrome, it leads a lot of charlatans all over the place to behave like Strategy is somehow a Ponzi or what have you. And they're not, right? Like by any definition, Strategy is not a Ponzi scheme. You know, I think, I don't know if you've spoken with Jeff Walton before, if you've had him on your show. If you haven't, I would highly suggest having him on because he went on CoffeeZilla's show and CoffeeZilla still has yet to actually upload the interview that he did with him. And he likened Strategy to an insurance company wherein basically with insurance companies, there's this big misconception that they're taking the assets on their balance sheet and liquidating them in order to pay insurance payouts. Well, that's actually not true. What they're doing is they're taking proceeds from monthly payments from individuals paying into their policies in order to pay out individuals who have claims. And so if you think about it like that, like, wouldn't that also make insurance a Ponzi scheme? And so like the argument sort of falls apart there once you understand that Ponzi schemes don't have assets, right? That's the major thing. Ponzi schemes don't have a balance sheet. It's genuinely all smoke and mirrors. There is no appreciating asset on the other end of this thing. All Strategy is doing is they're doing a carry trade, which is what you and I are both very familiar with, the carry trade, right? It's one of the popular ways in which U.S. investors invest in domestic assets. They borrow in the yen, which is a cheap, low-yielding currency, to invest in high-yielding U.S. dollar assets. That's just what Strategy is doing, right? They are borrowing more cheaply than Bitcoin's average compound annual growth rate, at least for the time being. And of course, in the event that Bitcoin's compound annual growth rate declines over time, they have the lever they need in order to decrease that dividend. So it's not something I'm worried about. And I, you know, in my mind, this is a very positive development. The knee-jerk reaction from the market to massively sell off, you might see a little bit more of that if Strategy decides to sell even more, which they might. But the important thing, number one, this is simply to inoculate the market. So taking your medicine always sucks. It's never fun. It's going to taste bad. In the long run, it'll be good for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great analogy as well. I mean, in the end, you inoculate the market. That's exactly what you're doing. And as you said, that's what a lot of people don't get. They have these levers. You know, it's not just a system where they like mindfully or mindlessly buy Bitcoin. They have actually thought about this quite carefully. And obviously, it is. That's what I always say. It's very clever financial engineering that we know from traditional world already. You know, having other people having it done with other assets, and now we're just doing on Bitcoin. You know. And if you believe in Bitcoin after all, then yeah, there should be a way out for this to work for sure. I mean, one thing that I'm still wondering is, like, given they have now over 840,000 Bitcoin or something, you know, why isn't Saylor never putting any of this to use in terms of, like, you know, generating a yield on its Bitcoin? Obviously, that creates some other risks as well, counterparty risks. But given he's already well established in the financial system, I've always wondered why not, yeah, generate a yield on it, you know, through financial engineering, you know, options trading, whatever. He hasn't done so far from what I can tell, but given that he has so many Bitcoins, he could just use a fraction of this and try things out, you know? So any thoughts on this?
You know, he absolutely could, but I'm happy he isn't. Reason being, he owns a fortress worth of Bitcoin. And if he were lending that out to any counterparty in order to generate a yield on it, even a low risk yield, that would become a target, right? Obviously, you and I both know that shorts love when people borrow Bitcoin on leverage and there is a stop loss, right? They absolutely love it because what do? They stop hunt. They begin hunting that stop loss and trying to push the price down in order to liquidate that individual. Now imagine if that was being done to the tune of almost a million Bitcoin, right? Like the motherload of all payouts if you can get down to that liquidation zone. So I'm happy he's not doing it. And also, we've seen the dangers of playing with fire and rehypothecating Bitcoin, or just at the very least, in this case, what it would be doing is taking the Bitcoin, using it as collateral to get some type of loan or using it as collateral elsewhere in order to generate a yield on it. I'm happy they're not doing it because in 2022, we saw the dangers of that. Celsius, Terra Luna, or not Terra Luna, Celsius, 3R's Capital, BlockFi, FTX, and others all exploded, right? Trying to farm yield from customers' assets. In this case, obviously, it wouldn't be customers' assets. It would be their own Bitcoin. But the same thing applies, right? I'm happy that they're not doing it because the risks associated with it are far too great, right? Ultimately, even though strategy is accumulating Bitcoin at just a monster of a pace, they're actually quite a conservative company. They're quite a conservative company in terms of what they do, in terms of their balance sheet. They have almost no leverage. And they're not playing any funny games with the assets on their balance sheet. All they're doing is they're buying Bitcoin and then they're using the proceeds of that Bitcoin to entice new investors and saying, hey, look, this Bitcoin is appreciating 30% a year, 25% a year. You want a slice of that? I'm gonna strip away all of the volatility. I'm going to give you 11.5%. If Bitcoin goes down, I'll take that hit. I might have to sell some Bitcoin, but I'm betting confidently that it can rise by 25%. And worst case scenario, I'll drop the yield to something like 8, 9, 10%, if need be. Does that sound like a deal? And the market has clearly voted, yeah, that sounds like a great deal. So it's, to me, not something to be worried about. And I think this is a very, very positive development for BTC. Not to sound like a broken record here, but yeah, it's great. Like it's classic financial engineering. I personally love to see it. And I'm happy that Saylor is not using his Bitcoin in order to generate yield. Because think about it this way too. Obviously, they've got a massive balance sheet worth of Bitcoin, but like, beyond what point is the percentage increases enough? Like, is 30% annually not enough? Is 20% annually not enough? Like, Bitcoin's 200-day moving average. It's 4-year moving average. It's 200-week moving average. Has never been below 29.5% if you do its compound annual growth rate over one resolution, two resolutions, three resolutions, so on. And so it's like, over any 4-year period with Bitcoin, you are guaranteed almost 30%. Guaranteed, even if you buy the Gigatop in 2021. Right? You are up 30% year over year. And so it's like ultimately over any 4-year period into 2025. And so ultimately it's like, beyond what point is that enough for you? You know, I just think it would be really greedy too. Like if they decided to lend it out and get even more yield on it, you know?
Hey guys, I'm thrilled to share my new book, The Bitcoin Enlightenment, co-authored with Mexican billionaire Ricardo Salinas. Make sure you grab your copy now and learn about how one of the richest people in all of Latin America thinks about Bitcoin. You'll find the link in the show notes.
Yeah. And I guess Saylor is well aware of this, of what you just said, and that's why he's very cautious. And you're right. I mean, Saylor is this very interesting person. You know, at some point, in some sense, he's like this Bitcoin maxi. He understands it. You know, he's been... so influential in getting many people to understand Bitcoin the way it needs to be understood. At the same time, he's very open to other things, you know, where a lot of other Bitcoin maxis sometimes kind of freak out. Then he's also very conservative, as you mentioned. But then, you know, he posts these AI slop images on X all the time, where also some people get freaked out. So he's just this very interesting character, you know. But I guess you're right. At the end, you need to look at how the company is doing and how it's structured and how it's set up. And it seems to be quite solid still. From my point of view, there's also not this very red flag risk where you would say, okay, now jump boat or jump ship because it's about to sink anytime soon. That's great. So, I mean, strategy is somewhat spooking the market right now, you know, and you were just mentioning, you know, Bitcoin's CAGR, it going up forever. A lot of people are currently questioning Bitcoin, you know, also a lot of newcomers, you know, who haven't been holding Bitcoin for quite some time, you know, and they're like, everything is up, you know,
your potatoes, your S&P, your whatever, call it. Every asset seems to be at an all-time high, yet Bitcoin is not. And so do you have an explanation, Joe, for why this is the case?
Yeah. So in my mind, it's simply a crowding out as a result of the AI trade. Like, if you think about it, the only thing investors are you know, excited about right now is the fact that SpaceX is IPOing soon, Anthropic is IPOing soon, OpenAI is IPOing soon. And so that's basically what's taking up a lot of the hype in markets right now. And if you think about it, there's only so many dollars that can go around. And so like the AI trade is becoming exceedingly popular. As a result, Bitcoin has decoupled from its historical correlation to software equities, right? What does that tell me? Well, it means one of two things, Pascal. Number one, Bitcoin is going to zero, which I don't think that's happening. Yeah. Or number two, software equities are getting bid up into the stratosphere because people are exhilarated about the AI trade. That's number one. I think the first component is that big crowding in the AI trade. I don't think AI is a bubble. I think at some stage, not this year, at some stage, we will see crazy overvaluation. Right now, earnings are actually supporting most valuations by modern standards, right? Still crazy high PE ratios, but nothing that we haven't seen before. I think you start to get into bubble territory, maybe late 2027, maybe late 2029. That's like way far out. Like, we're not in a bubble yet. And we might not even get there. Like, we might be entering into an era where we see crazy high earnings growth as a result of, I mean, I don't know. But the reality is, like, the dynamic is that there's only so much capital to go around. Investors are more interested in the AI trade. That's number one. So they're selling Bitcoin, or at least not paying up as much. Number two, and we know this because a couple of things, like one of the main ways we know this is that the Coinbase premium for institutional investors is deeply negative, and it flipped deeply negative back in October. Like, wouldn't you know it? Once Bitcoin started underperforming severely. So US-based institutional investors are selling BTC in order to buy software names that are more directly correlated to AI. So that's number one. Number two is that, you know, it could be the case that Bitcoin is sniffing out the geopolitical risks much more accurately than equities are. That could also be the reason for Bitcoin's underperformance. It's not so much why is Bitcoin underperforming, it's why on earth is everything else going up while we have a war raging in Iran and inflation expectations for next month over 4%. And the fact that we are falling and bond yields exploding to their highest level since 2007, at least in the 30-year and the 10-year. And like, why on earth is everything going up despite that? So Bitcoin might actually be the only asset in the room that's accurately pricing in the optimism surrounding the war. You know, and this also, it's almost the one of the reasons Bitcoin is really nice is because it's sort of a pure play macro asset. It has no balance sheet risk, no corporate governance risk, no equity risk, anything that's associated with investing in the stock market. And so, but it trades risk on. And so it's just a pure expression of risk on, risk off sentiment. And so because Bitcoin started selling off back in October, and granted, since the start of the Iran war, it's still the best performing asset, right? But actually, I think that might not be the case anymore now that we're back down to 71. But regardless, for a while it was. I think that was because there was general optimism around the war ending. As the war has raged on and we are approaching the mid-June threshold, which Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, they've all cited as the threshold at which the SPRs globally dry up, the major nation strategic petroleum reserves dry up, and you see massive inflation as a result. As we approach that threshold and the war seems no closer to ending, then Bitcoin is selling off even more. And so it doesn't surprise me. So in my mind, it's those two reasons in tandem. Number one, capital is fleeing elsewhere. But secondary, more importantly, Bitcoin may be the only asset that's accurately sniffing out the major geopolitical risks on the horizon and the potential inflationary recession we might be entering into if we don't end the war. So that's why I named my latest video something crazy. I think it was Bitcoin is about to make everyone look stupid. Not because Bitcoin is going to be appreciating massively, but because everything else might not be accurately pricing in the risks here, and Bitcoin is the only accurate one that is.
Yeah, it's some interesting two points. I mean, on the first one, you're definitely right. I think that's what we're seeing. I mean, given that I work at a bank as well here in Switzerland, you know, we have so many people approaching us, asking us on how to get in on the SpaceX IPO, and then also if there's already some early entry points for the Anthropic or OpenAI thing, you know. So that's definitely what we're seeing, especially also crypto people, you know, have made a ton of money with Bitcoin and crypto, and now just want to chase the new shiny thing on the block, so to say. In terms of the other point that you brought up, I'd be curious to know, because I mean, one could argue that Bitcoin started correcting back in October, or not argue, it actually started correcting back in October, you know. And there, some people were already saying the same thing, that it is sounding the alarm because we had this SOFR stress, you know, back in August, September of 2025.
and Bitcoin then kind of corrected. And then a lot of people were saying, well, you know, a stock market correction is due, but it hasn't really come. And some people were saying it was already sniffing out the war, you know, and so my point being, is this also such just a story we like to tell each other, you know, and we attribute this to Bitcoin, but in all reality, it's just been the Bitcoin cycle, you know, coming to an end. And that's why everything turned over. And now we're looking for an explanation.
I mean, I honestly think it could be a little bit of both. I think maybe at the beginning, because I don't know if anyone was pricing in an Iran war in October. So I think maybe in the beginning, it was a general de-risking. It wasn't Bitcoin native, but the reason Bitcoin has sold off since then and is still selling off since then. And the reason I say it wasn't Bitcoin native is because software stocks began turning down at that exact same time too. So, but maybe since then, I think there's a case to be made that a lot of the selling has just been reflexive, right? If you expect Bitcoin to go down at a certain date and then bottom at a certain date, that's going to create a self-reinforcing loop of behavior in markets where investors just sell out of anticipation of the asset doing poorly. And so even though there actually isn't a reason for the four-year cycle to have a stranglehold on Bitcoin anymore, like there's actually no reason for it now that 20 million Bitcoin have been mined, it still seems to have a stranglehold on Bitcoin. And so like that could be it, but I think also it's exacerbated by the macro backdrop for sure. And, you know, I'm of the opinion that the four-year cycle is dead, but clearly I am close to wrong. I mean, we've bottomed out in February. If Bitcoin falls another $11,000, then that would mean the four-year cycle is still right. So we'll have to wait and see. Like if Bitcoin hits a new low before October, then the four-year cycle is still intact. If Bitcoin manages to not make a new low and begins trending higher and enters into a new bull market before or after October, then the four-year cycle is dead. So we'll still have to wait and see. But it seems like team four-year cycle is still in the lead here.
Interesting. Why would you say it would kind of show that it's wrong? Wouldn't that exactly be the case for it to be right again, you know? Because a lot of people are saying, well, October, November last year was exact topping time, you know, it came around at this time, it would take about 12 months for it to bottom and then enter into a new bull market. And that would also be by the October, November timeframe that you just brought up. So a lot of people would say if we see this, you know, then Bitcoin, the four-year cycle has just been sort of established once again, you know. Or why would you say it would be proven wrong then?
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure, I could be wrong, I'm pretty sure the four-year cycle posits that Bitcoin bottoms, not like forms a bottom, but bottoms a year after or 18 months after the halving. I could be wrong though. So that's why I say that, is because like typically, and you saw this in 2022 as well, I'm pretty sure, 18 months after the halving, or relatively speaking, Bitcoin found its low of 16,000.
Yeah.
Same thing back in 2017. So that's why I think it would invalidate the four-year cycle and it would be hugely bullish. We'll have to wait and see. And, you know, to another point there is that one of the most bullish things for Bitcoin is that every cycle we sort of invalidate the false gospel, if you will, with the lowercase g of the prior cycle. So, you know, back in 2021, we broke the narrative that Bitcoin can never break below its prior cycle's all-time high. We broke that narrative. So like we went all the way up to 20,000 and then we went up to 61 and then 69 and then we fell back below 20,000, which was the 2017 all-time high. And we did it again. We, you know, the last cycle's all-time high was 69,000. We went all the way up to 126 and then we broke down below 69,000. And so it's actually, in my mind, healthy that these narratives get broken, because if people take these things as gospel and then they break down the line when Bitcoin is a much more valuable asset, that could have a much more catastrophic outcome, right? And so I, for one, am happy that these narratives are being broken and disproven. And another big narrative, and this is why I'm mentioning this, one of the other major narratives surrounding Bitcoin is that if Strategy sells its Bitcoin, it's game over. So silly. So completely and utterly silly. And so Strategy selling their Bitcoin, not because they need to, but because they have to, or not because they have to, but because they need to, rather, is actually a really, really bullish thing in my mind, because it's destroying yet another one of the old wives' tales that a lot of Bitcoin bears, and even Bitcoiners, like a lot of Bitcoiners hold this belief, which is just really silly in my mind. Like, you need to be totally illiterate in terms of corporate finance to say like Strategy is a Ponzi scheme, and if they sell, they're going to become forced sellers. You must understand, they hold only a few million dollars worth of leverage on their balance sheet, and they have a $60 billion balance sheet. Right? That's like saying, okay, I've got $1 million net worth, but I've got $10,000 in credit card debt. What do I do? This is terrible, right? Like, no, actually, you're fine. You're more than fine. And so like, in my mind, not to be rude, but it's like I see a lot of Bitcoiners who just completely lambast strategy and say that they're, you know, but it's total financial illiteracy in my mind, because like all of the data is public. All of it's, you can see their balance sheet in real time. You can see their leverage ratios. So I digress. Point being, in my mind, it's really bullish that time and again, we're disproving these narratives around Bitcoin.
You're exactly right in terms of like these narratives being shattered. You know, there was also, I think there was also this narrative, you know, that Bitcoin can't ever reach an all-time high before the halving, you know, and that was another one in 2024, I think, which proved out to be wrong after all. And so it's kind of good to make away with these narratives, given that people really cling to it. But that's just hard, you know, as an investor, usually. I mean, if you would have divested last year in October, it would have been just great, you know. So there's also these things that you need to juggle. But I mean, thinking of investors, you know, a lot of people are also kind of worried. Analogy that you had, you know, the smoke detector analogy with Bitcoin, you know, being okay, something is wrong with the entire financial system. That's why Bitcoin is red and everything else is green. So a lot of people have been saying, okay, if it's actually true and stock markets will correct a bunch, you know, because we're sliding into this inflationary recession or whatever or whatnot, then Bitcoin might be poised to go down another 30-50%. What's your take there, you know?
Yeah, I think that Bitcoin is already down 42%. And so, well, there are a few things. Number one, what I'll say is that Bitcoin has never lived through a prolonged recession before. And that's not because Bitcoin is, you know, doing something wrong. It's because recessions have functionally been outlawed in the United States. Every time the United States has approached a recession, you and I both know that they turn on the money printer. Like back in 2023 was the latest example that comes to mind. Silicon Valley Bank collapsed. First Republic Bank collapsed. 80% of depositors fleed within 48 hours or something like that. And instead of allowing the leverage in the system to unwind, they did what they did in 2008, but just with a faster response time, they created a facility out of thin air where banks could post their undervalued treasuries at par value to basically get the cash difference from the Federal Reserve and allow the game to continue getting played. In my mind, that should have kicked off a recession that likely would have been resolved by now. But unfortunately, every single time something like that occurs, the Fed chooses to bail out the system and inflate the dollar instead of allowing the natural business cycle to take course. And so as a result of that, recessions just don't occur, unfortunately, and I don't think they will. But the thing is, Bitcoin, unfortunately, has never lived through a major recession, and so we'll have to see how it behaves. I tend to think that like every other asset, initially, it will sell off massively as there's this initial dash for liquidity, but I tend to think that it will be one of the best performing assets over the ensuing, you know, 6, 12, 18 months, as it has been in other crises we've experienced. Now, to your question about the inflationary recession, it all boils down to whether or not we can exit this war with Iran soon or not. In my mind, I'm listening to the experts as far as geopolitics and oil is concerned and saying mid-June is the threshold where if we don't wrap that war up before mid-June, the likelihood of an inflationary recession this year is higher than not. And the thing with an inflationary recession is that it's not being caused by pull inflation. So it's not being caused by consumers who are overextended on credit cards and buying too much stuff. It's caused by push inflation, where you have input-driven inflation, right? You and I both know that petroleum is one of the biggest inputs for basically everything in the modern economy, not just your gas in your car, but the diesel that goes into the machinery and the equipment that, you know, works on the farm for your food, right? It goes into the, it's a huge input into the fertilizer to grow your food. It's a massive input into just about every single product out there. This phone, those behind you, right? The paints on your wall, all of it is petroleum based in one way or another. And so when you see the price of WTI crude jump from $40 to $50, and then all of a sudden to above $100 and stay there for coming up on 4 months now, right? In a couple of weeks, it'll have been at that level for about 4 months since the war began. Then all of a sudden, you have a repricing of every asset in the economy. That creates massive inflation. That's not a type of inflation the Fed can fix. So the Fed can fix inflation that's driven by too much consumer spending, and they do that really easily. They pull one of many levers. Number one, they raise interest rates. They make it harder for banks to borrow. They make it more difficult for consumers to borrow, right? And they naturally rein in spending as a result. They crush inflation that way. The other way is that you stop expanding your balance sheets. You stop buying off-the-run treasuries from banks in order to give them cash in exchange. However, those tools are largely ineffective, if not counterproductive, when the inflation is not caused by the consumer, when it's caused by an input. The only thing you accomplish by raising rates is you make it harder for the consumer, right? So actually by raising rates during an inflation or a recession, you're actually counterintuitively making it worse and increasing the odds of a recession. Same thing with doing quantitative tightening. And that's, in my mind, one of the reasons that we are still on this program buying 40 billion treasuries a month and expanding the balance sheet. Bank reserves were at a critically low level back in December. And so we began this buying program. If anything, I think the only path for that is to accelerate, right? And so the Fed is caught between a rock and a hard place. You raise rates, all of a sudden you make it really difficult for the Treasury to finance its debt. And heading into the summer when consumers are already stretched thin as a result of inflation, you make it harder for them to borrow. Or you cut rates and then make the inflation that they're feeling worse. So it's a tricky situation. I will love to see how they thread the needle here. I think the path of least resistance is to end the war, but it remains to be seen. I'm not a geopolitics expert. I don't know what we're going to do over there. The easiest way to solve all of this would be to end the war, but I don't know if we're going to do that. So
I was just going to ask, like, what's the way out? What do you think? Because like in the end, what's the sentiment like in the US as well with midterms coming around, you know? And a lot of people are saying, okay, at some point Trump will have to wind this down because otherwise, he's not going to win. And we're now, June just started, you know, and it's not that much out when these elections will be taken or held. And so, what do you think? How much of an effect will that have? And then also, what's the sentiment like after all? And maybe the last question to weave in here, was that Trump's goal after all? Because he knew by going into this war, you know, he might create higher oil prices, will then kind of affect, prices. But it's exactly that the price inflation that the Fed can not really fight. And that's why he wasn't worried about the Fed raising rates. So, a lot of inputs here, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think he was thinking about the consumer, unfortunately. And like, this is unfortunate because I voted for the guy, and I voted for the guy twice. He's the only president that I've actually voted for because I'm not old enough to have voted for him the first time. But it's like, I'm quite disappointed in the fact that he decided to enter this war because one of his promises was no new wars. So that sucks. He's fulfilling his promise as far as migration is concerned, but the war promise, he's not fulfilling that. The inflation promise, he's not fulfilling that. And so you got to think, like, with midterms approaching, and there was a clip where he literally said to a reporter, I don't care about Americans' financial situation. So that's not ideal. He's clearly very wrapped up in this war and he wants to win. For what reason that is, I don't know, right? Could be foreign influence. I think it is a lot of foreign influence. But like, ultimately, the question then becomes, okay, midterms are approaching. What does he do? What's the decision-making matrix? Well, if you got to think about it in terms of incentives, right? If he no longer has the disinflation and he no longer has the no new wars, the only other thing he has is asset prices. And so think about it this way. Going into midterms, in order to make sure the Republicans maintain the majority in the House and the Senate, what he has to do is make sure that asset prices are juiced into the stratosphere. And the easiest way to do that is to end the war sooner than later. Right. You might still get some inflation because the pass-through effect hasn't reached every end good in the consumer economy yet, but you will get higher asset prices and you might even get disinflation. So ending the war, in my mind, is what he has to do in order to secure the Republicans, the House and the Senate in November. If he doesn't do that sooner than later, I think it's a sweep. I think the Democrats win both the House and the Senate. I think that increases the likelihood of the Dems winning in 2028. And then I think terrible things happen to Republicans after that, because the Democrats have said that they are going to go on a war path once they get power again. So I'm personally not looking forward to that.
No, but that's the tricky situation. I mean, as of now, I'm with you on that. But then if you look at markets, most of the markets, as we just established, are at an all-time high, So for this, Trump is like, okay, asset prices are at an all-time high. That's why I maybe don't have to end the war yet. But then there's this critical point in time, which that might topple over, and then it comes crashing down and then he might already be late. So it's better now than late, because he never knows when he loses sort of the situation or when it gets out of control. But that's exactly the thing. I mean, he needs to juice up asset prices, but so far, apart from BTC, asset prices are high, and that's thanks to the AI trade that we maybe established and stuff. And so it's all these moving parts, but it's definitely going to be interesting going into the sort of the end of the year for sure. Yeah.
It's a fun time to be alive. What I can say is that, like, expect volatility this summer. I've said it before and we're getting it now and it's fun. Like, Bitcoin is at $71,000, which is crazy because, like, when Michael Saylor buys billions of dollars of Bitcoin, the market doesn't move. And then when he sells like a couple million, they act like it's the end of the world. It's crazy. But, you know, it's like we're in for a volatile summer. I think the geopolitical tensions will only rise. I think the inflation risks will only rise.
Yeah.
You have to drop. Was that with the fact that the U.S. economy is growing very rapidly? And the fact that AI is massively deflationary, which in my mind will necessitate a lot of inflation. So it's an interesting time to be alive. What I can say is that, like, you don't want to be underallocated, but by the same token, have a ton of cash waiting and ready. Just
yeah, that's exactly. That's, again, these juxtaposing positions. You need to be allocated for sure, because we all know things can rip really fast. But then at the same time, we can get these very volatile down corrections where it's just a gift from God, so to say, if you can then kind of allocate again. But maybe last question, from here on out, how do you think about BTC then? Also in terms of price, you know, not giving any financial advice, obviously, but like price targets, you know, I know everyone has been looking at the short-term holder cost basis, the 200-day moving average, the true market mean. We're all down below these now. And so what's next for BTC? You know, where's maybe a threshold that we can look for it to maybe form a bottom again? Or yeah, how do you think about it?
Yeah, so ultimately, it's really unfortunate that we lost those three levels. Like, Bitcoin was so close to breaking above the 200-day moving average, and in my mind, officially flipping into a bull market, because that has historically been the demarcation line between bull mm-hmm. and bear. We couldn't break that. It was at 83K at the time. Now it's at about 80K. You know, then we fell underneath the short-term holder cost basis, which is a level that gets staunchly defended by people who are new to Bitcoin and typically are the primary investor during bull markets. And then we fell below the true market mean, which is an even better measure of the average cost basis across the network that also factors in the ETF cost basis and removes lost coins as well. And so the fact that we fell below all three of those levels confirms pretty staunchly that we are still in a bear market, unfortunately. And so the next levels that I'd be looking out for, right, we're at one right now, 70K, beneath that 65K, right around the prior all-time high, the first all-time high during 2021, and then underneath that, the lows that were set at 60K. You know, I think the lows at 60K will get scooped up yet again. They were massively scooped up the last time we saw them. Like, when we saw them in February, we spent probably 5 minutes there before rocketing back up to 62. So I imagine those levels will be staunchly defended to the downside. And if we lose 60K, not really ideal, right? I would say that, like, worst case scenario, awful, terrible bear market floor. I've said like 45K in January on what Bitcoin did. You know, I still hold to that as like absolute worst case scenario. I don't think Bitcoin goes any lower than that. But realistically, I think we hold 60K pretty firmly. And yeah, so yeah, we'll have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see what happens exactly. But as you already said, things are going to be volatile. Things are going to be exciting. And yeah, it's just interesting to watch and be alive at these interesting times. So yeah, thanks a lot, Joe, for coming on to the show. Yeah, where can people reach out to you? What's your YouTube channel called that you mentioned? Maybe you can quickly drop that as well.
Of course. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having me on, man. Always great to chat with you. If viewers want to see more of this type of analysis, if you found this valuable, if this is a collaboration, you can just click right down there, click onto both of our names, then click Joe Consorti, hit subscribe. Or if you're just watching on YouTube, you can go up to the search bar right there, type Joe Consorti, exactly the same way it's spelled in this title, and then find my YouTube there. Check out some of the content, subscribe if you enjoy.
That's great. Thanks a lot for doing this, Joe, and talk to you later.
Likewise. Thanks, man.